Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Doing very well. Well, this week you wanted to talk about the so-called Irish potato famine. That's it's become to be known. You want to address that. That you say that's somewhat of a misnomer, and I think the research bears that out. The great hunger that was perpetrated on the Irish people in the 1840s, 1845 to 1850, roughly. It's called the Great Famine, also the Great Hunger. This is according to Wikipedia. It was a period of mass starvation, disease, and emigration in Ireland between 1845 and 1852. It's sometimes referred to mostly outside Ireland as the Irish Potato Famine. I wonder why it's mostly outside Ireland, because about two-fifths of the population was solely reliant on the cheap crop for a number of historical reasons. Well, we're going to flesh out those historical reasons. During the famine, this says only about 1 million people died, and a million more emigrated. Of course, those numbers are, I think, are far more grim. I think the Irish population was cut in half, essentially, by that by the Great Hunger. So the Irish potato famine, the proximate cause was this potato blight. That afflicted Europe and America and Ireland. I think it was brought in from the New World. But for various reasons, Irish agriculture, well, Irish people, the most of the Irish people were kept dependent on potatoes by the British and Irish landlords for various economic, political, and probably demographic reasons. So how do you want to get into it?
Well, first I would... recommend everyone listen to the interview you did with Mr. Fogarty and attend his website, The Irish Holocaust. And he's very clear that we need to call it a Holocaust because it deserves the what occurred to the Irish people deserves, you know, a specific reference to the fact that this wasn't a natural disaster, but rather this was basically man-made. That's the first thing that we want to, I think, you know, point out to people is that I certainly was unaware of this, and you're really the one who brought me, you know, to focus upon it. And I listened to the interview you did with Mr. Fogarty, and I was just astounded at how little I knew about this, even though I had actually been aware of the fact that there was some deliberate activity. I just didn't know the scope of the British activity, and I actually want to change that too. It's, and I think this is something I hope that what is Mr. Fogarty's first name? So I don't keep calling him Mr. Fogarty.
Chris Fogarty.
Chris.
He has his book Ireland 1845 to 1850: The Perfect Holocaust and Who Kept It Perfect. You can purchase that book at that website. The proceeds from the book actually go to raising awareness of the true story behind the Great Hunger in Ireland, and also building monuments and recognizing the numerous mass graves that dot the Irish landscape.
Yeah, the dozens of mass graves that I just was completely unaware of. But I think Chris can actually do better as far as getting the public to understand what happened by removing the title British or elite and just substituting Freemason, because I've gone through the political class that was involved with this as best I can, and it's completely Freemasonic. The famine, people talk about it starting in 45, but actually it had been going on for 100 years. I mean, the British Freemasons had taken control of the political power of Ireland. They'd made it into a colony. And so they distributed the land among themselves, and the people who were on the land were basically serfs, slaves, right? And they had reduced their food. Chris goes into this in the interview he did with you, that actually the hunger was long-standing. And when the potato crop failed, this was really had nothing to do with what brought about the starvation. What brought about the starvation is that the British were taking all of the food out of Ireland. And things that people need to know about the food removal is, first of all, I would recommend both the interview you did with Chris and his website, the Irish Holocaust, because he has all the details. And I want to compliment him. He did a great job of research. And there you can read the actual bills of lading that reference exactly how much food was being taken out on any particular day, because there's records of all of this. And you can see that the British were extracting the food, and they were doing so under gunpoint. As it turns out, and another fact just amazed me, is half of the British military forces were occupied in Ireland during this period. I mean, that should tell you exactly what was going on. They were deliberately starving the people. It was a deliberate genocide, right? This wasn't, and you can see that it wasn't because the potatoes had failed. It was because the Masonic elite had decided to reduce population. And so Chris shows that you have these boats that are receiving all of the food that the military are stealing from the Irish countryside, and then they're taking them back to England, and from there, you know, they're distributed in different ways. They're basically commercializing, you know, the Irish food. But when you look at these, manifests of what's being taken out, and realize that this is at the exact same time that the countryside is starving, you get an idea of how deliberate and how evil this is. I'm just going to read, if you don't mind, just this one manifest of what was taken by a single boat. And this left from Cork Harbor in 1847. It's called the Ajax. And it had 1,500 firkins of butter. These are big bills. 102 casks of pork, 44 hogshead of whiskey, 844 sacks of oat, 247 sacks of wheat, 106 bales of bacon, 13 casks of ham, 145 casks of porter, 12 sacks of fodder, 28 bales of feathers, 8 sacks of lard, 296 boxes of eggs, 30 head of cattle, 90 pigs, 220 lambs, 34 calves, and 69 miscellaneous packages. Wow. A couple days later, it basically took even more stuff, or they have another bill of lading that is going out. Okay, so the idea that the potatoes were the problem, right, is just a cover narrative so that people don't realize what happened. And what I want to mention, Tim, is that I think that the documentation of the Masonic genocide of the Irish people is so clear that it should have ramifications today, right? We should be looking at this and realizing that when we see something like 9/11 or the Mideast wars, this is exactly the same process. This is the Masonic control of the forces in the Civil War. This is World War I, where they're putting people into automatic weapon fire. And in Ireland, you actually have completely clear evidence. I mean, it's just, you go through the documentation that Chris has created, and it is just overwhelming. They deliberately reduced the population of the Irish. And, it's interesting, but one of the points you can start the process is something that, that Chris doesn't mention, but it's with good old Lord Palmerston, right? He owned a gigantic fraction of the Irish countryside. Lord Palmerston, that Masonic cesspool. He's the guy who was the head mason of the Orient. He was the one who ran the British gunships. He was actually in control of the fleet that went up and killed the Chinese who tried to resist the opium addiction. And so he was the one who actually did the first forced slave emigration of Irish people. He took 2,000 people, and this was very early on. I think it was 1845. He put them on a boat, and he took them to Canada to work as slaves. He took them off his plantation, the land that he had in Ireland, and he sent them to the New World. And there is a recording of the conditions on the ship by this guy, and he says it was worse than on a slave boat.
Yeah.
Right. Many people died just in the transportation across. So Palmerston, it's amazing that you see him popping up here at the very beginning, because you have to remember we did that show where mm-hmm. Palmerston was also the origin of Zionism. He was the very first Zionist, really. I mean, I think it was 1848, he made the proclamation that became, you know, the beginning of all the other proclamations, that the Jews want to return to the homeland.
He was heavily indebted to the Rothschilds.
Yeah, that's right. So
this is a theme that runs through the British aristocracy and ruling elite.
Well, you know what I'm seeing is, and I've mentioned this to you a number of times, but if you look at things like the conversation about LSD, which is basically it's on YouTube, and I think you've probably seen it. And it's basically it's an MKUltra reunion party. I mean, after the fact, now that we've uncovered the MKUltra documents and done all the research, we can see that every single person in the room was involved in the destruction of the young people of America, that they were deliberately creating the counterculture and they were doing it malevolently. And you have this odd combination of basically Jews and people with connections into masonry.
Mm-hmm.
Humphrey Osmond and Tim Leary and Huxley's wife, you know. And you wonder, well, what holds these guys together? Because here, Chris, in your conversation with him, he didn't really mention, that I'm aware, the Masonic connection. And I think that that's really the key, in my opinion, to getting his research to, you know, the most perfected place.
Yeah,
is that
when he gets it, I'll listen to some other interviews he did.
Yeah.
He does broach the idea of the something about people in positions of political leadership being genocidal.
Right, and when they are.
Yeah, and
but
so...
But you have to answer that statement. You can't just put it out there. And see, this is the thing, is that... you can take it to the point where you can say the Masons at this level, at the level of Palmerston and Peel, Robert Peel, who was the next prime minister, who then went forward with the British policies of the food removal. They are famous Masons. And so therefore you can say, well, the Masons, it's not the British elite. That phrase isn't, it's a correct phrase, but it just isn't precise enough. It's the British Masons who have taken control of the political structure, and they, for some reason, have genocide. Right.
I mean, this is the thing that runs through Masonic projects, Judeo-Masonic projects, because you have Mao in China, communism being a Masonic, you know, Judeo-Masonic creation. Of course, the in the Ukraine, the Holodomor, you know. So, yeah, this is all part about population reduction, destruction, and, you know.
Yeah. So the thing is, when you look at like the Holodomor, excuse me. I actually know how to say this because I went to YouTube and got the pronunciation.
The proper Ukrainian.
Yeah, so because I couldn't figure out how to say it. But anyway, Holodomor. It was the, as everyone hopefully is aware, it was the Ukrainian people's Holocaust. And it was created and it was run by, you know, this Masonic Bolshevik, Yagoda, who was Jewish and a Mason, was basically in charge of the project, working with Stalin, whose background into Masonry is well established. And they were able to have the moral authority to basically starve between 10 and 20 million people. We don't know how many, Tim, because, you know, one thing about us Europeans, we're not good at counting. You see,
we just
don't know. I mean, it's like the thing with the Irish. You know, you get people saying that it was 1 million, 5 million. No one heck knows.
Yeah, well, Stalin said one death is a tragedy, a million deaths are an abstraction, or a statistic.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so. What's interesting to me is you have this here again, you have this combination, because clearly the Masons are in control. The British Masonic political class is owning Ireland at this point. They're deliberately deciding to reduce the population. And because of Chris's research, you can actually trace very well the exact, you know, points where the genocide is going on. He's got these mass graves all exposed. But he mentioned something in his interview with you that I thought was very interesting. You brought up the possibility that there could be some kind of Jewish connection into this. And Chris said he referenced Jewish bankers and landowners in London that were receiving benefit from the food removal.
Yeah, more or less the food removal. It was more or less paying off the interest on the loans that the landlords had. Their property was mortgaged.
Right. Yeah, that was the idea. In other words, there is this kind of bizarre cover narrative where they're taxing the land and the people, and that's why that's their justification for taking all the food. But then they're also claiming that the starvation was caused by the potato famine's failure.
Yeah, and blaming it on the stupid Irish.
Right, and the Irish, because they have their dietary habits are poor, and so therefore they starve death. So, but you see, this is just preposterous, and modern Irish politicians, we'll get into this, are still towing the line of the Masonic cover story. That the failure of the potato crop was somehow responsible for the starvation when this obviously wasn't the case. But I just wanted to finish my point, is that I would hope that Chris would really go into this, because, you know, you have Palmerston basically starting, you can almost see him as in so many of these things, as kind of one of the points of entrance of the whole process. But Palmerston was also the first Zionist. Palmerston had relations, you know, with the Quattro Coronati Lodge, mm-hmm. which then produces all of the Zionist activity. Disraeli, who is sort of his protege, then is the person who then puts Herzl, you know, the original Jewish Zionist, into motion. So Palmerston has this oddball relation to Jews, to Judaism, and to Zionism. And it's very strange. I mean, remember this, when Palmerston came up with the first, the Jews going to go back to the homeland, there are Jewish historians who have like said, well, that's news to the Jews.
Yeah.
We have no idea about this. You know, where does this Palmerston guy come up with this idea? But you see, so you have this mystery that I think is at the core of everything here, is you have Jewish interests, and in the food removal process, they, you know, or Chris alludes to them as landowners and bankers, I believe, in a kind of cooperation with Masons, right? Now, how does that cooperation work? What is in back of it? Because, you see, it doesn't. If this was the only case of it, then we could say, well, you know, okay, it's just a strange thing. But you just see this time and time again, right? You find people that are related into Masonry, and then they have some oddball relationship to Jewish banking families, to Jewish media individuals, and you have this cooperation. And the reason I'm trying to find out about this is because, you know, we are suffering from the activity of a secret society. And when you go through Chris's website, I mean, it just is a punch in the gut. It's a punch in the gut because you can see that it wasn't, you know, a million Irish people. It was probably 5 million that got wiped out in this thing.
He also points out that throughout Irish history under British control, you've had three peaks of genocidal. First there's Cromwell, and then there's Queen Elizabeth, and then Queen Victoria. So you have these peaks, but nevertheless, you've had the Norman Conquest, Ireland, was the 1160s, I believe, a century after they conquered England, the British Isle, you know, Great Britain. But I think that the key moment was the Protestant Reformation, which gave the British sort of a religious excuse to go in and immiserate the Irish people. Irish people didn't have any status as human beings, I think, legally up until the late 18th century, 1828, when you had this sort of gradual Catholic emancipation occurring in the British Empire. So what you have was centuries of sort of dispossession, immiseration, and enslavement. And then all of a sudden you have these episodes of mass killing, mass death. Yep. Yeah. And if you want to look at the broad, you talk about the Freemasonry and the war on populations. I think in the beginning of the 19th century, Ireland's population was 2/3 of that of Great Britain. And now it is 1/12 of Great Britain.
Yep. And there's the you know, effect of the genocide. And the other, you know, maybe we want to stay with some of these topics, but another topic I want to at least bring up is that there is the idea that Ireland was a Catholic theocracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's complete nonsense. The Catholics never had any political power in this country. I mean, they had zip. If you look to the period when they were supposedly in control, like Trinity College, mm-hmm. which is a major university, completely controlled by Masonic Protestants. The main newspaper, the Irish Times, absolute Masonic cesspool. Protestant Masons, they had special privileges in terms of state education. I think even like half of the first four presidents were Masonic Protestants, just openly, right? The mayor of Dublin was a Jew, right? Even mm-hmm. though they were a smaller minority than the Protestants. If you look into the like employment hiring, the Catholics were discriminated against.
Yeah, yeah.
Open employment discrimination, like by things like the Guinness Brewery, that Irish, you know, kind of famous icon. It practiced open employment discrimination against Catholics until this was like up to like 1970.
Yeah, and there was a movement, sort of a not a divestment movement, but in the United States by Irish here in the United States to raise awareness of this, and local politicians were brought in to suppress that movement.
Right.
This extent showing the influence, the influence of the British, aka the Masons, here in the United States. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean Dublin is actually laid out as like a Masonic grid structure, like Washington D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So.
The seat of political power in Ireland and in the supposed independent, you know, Ireland, independence 1922, supposedly 22-23. When the British left, they installed a puppet government, more or less.
A Masonic puppet government. Yeah. And I think you had a lot of crypto Catholics, but there is absolutely no question in my mind that the Catholics have never had any real political power in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
That it's been a slave state since the Masons took political power. It's hard to trace exactly when that happened, but this was hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And the population has been basically, they've been mind controlled into subservience, right? and not just mind control, they've also been basically controlled by force of arms,
mm-hmm.
you know, as in the case during the famine, so-called potato famine, which I don't want to, during the Holocaust, when you had half of the British army in this little tiny island, making sure the population didn't get anything to eat, you know? So it's really important to bring this stuff out because I think this will help us understand life here in America.
Well, what's interesting is just to the extent that this real history has been suppressed, even by, you're talking about events of 160, 170 years ago, but to this day, efforts are made to suppress it because to expose it would be to pull it would challenge the legitimacy of the current system, the global order, because the British Empire, all these things are so much of what the modern world consists of is the British Empire, the Masonic world, and these things. You want to expose these crimes. So there are efforts being made, even efforts to establish monuments in Ireland. Even the Catholic Catholic Church has come out against it in Ireland because they don't want to offend their British overlords. You have Chris Fogarty himself was a victim. He was targeted by the FBI for his activism. Now, what dogs the FBI have in this fight? But apparently, there's enough pull with from the British, but MI5, to get an FBI agent to try to frame him for murder, and he beat the charge because there are some people who leaked some information within the FBI. But the FBI itself as an institution was being utilized by the British to go after this activist here in the United States who was raising consciousness over the true nature of the Great Hunger in Ireland. And this shows you the reach and what you know what's at stake here. They're still interested in suppressing this, suppressing the truth to this day.
Yeah.
You know, to this day.
That's so well said. I mean, that's you see, this is why it's so important to get this information out. I mean, you know, I try to stay current, and I was unaware of the extent of the documentation and the extent of the Holocaust and the extent of the Masonic control. And so this helps understand the world. You see this now when you look through this lens, you can make sense of the United States. And they control by lifetime actors. That's one of the things that I hope Chris can focus on in as he develops, you know, his research and his website. I mean, you get people like Mary Robinson, right? Now, she's supposedly a Catholic. See, this is how they do it. This is how they do it. They elect Mary Robinson. I think she was elected in like the 90s, 1990s, in that era, as the prime minister, right? You know, she's a woman. She's a Catholic. She's the darling of, you know, the liberals.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is... that her husband was the second most senior Freemason in Ireland. Their family is completely Masonic. After she left the PM's position, the British Grand Lodge honored her as like this great Freemason. The people that know her claim that she had been she was a Rothschild agent even since she was a kid. And that they say, well, look, they point to the fact that she had this very, very, very elaborate apartment in central Dublin, complete with a maid, even while she was studying for her law degree. She's supposedly coming from a humble background. And then she marries like the senior most, Freemason in Ireland. So she's obviously a cutout of somebody. But then, you know, she becomes like the normal ardent British Israelism person, right? Global liberalism, you know, we've got to like have one world government. Israel is like a big deal to her. And you just get these themes over and over again, right?
Yeah, why would an Irish politician be worrying about Israel?
Yeah, and why would an Irish be worried about one world government? Doesn't she have enough problems in Ireland?
Yeah, there was that guy, member of Parliament, Shatter is his name, I think is he's Jewish, and he was lecturing the Irish for not having a Holocaust memorial in Dublin. And no one, I think Chris Fogarty points this out, says, well, no one bothered to ask him, well, is there a memorial for the Irish Holocaust in Tel Aviv?
Right, which would be know, in fact, a lot more appropriate in many ways because of perhaps this Jewish background that we want to like flesh out in terms of how the whole function of the Irish Holocaust was actually working economically.
Yeah, because Israel itself is a Rothschild Masonic project, and Rothschild was the creditors to these landlords who are extracting the wealth, the food, and the wealth from Ireland to pay off their mortgage, make their mortgage payments. A lot of the food also was exported to Jamaica to feed slaves. So the Irish were being starved to feed slaves. That's the status that the Irish had.
Yeah.
In New Orleans, when they were building the canals in the early 19th century, they didn't use slaves because it was too risky. They used Irish.
Yeah.
Who died in the droves, you know.
Yeah. They deliberately suppress education to keep them from basically having the mental capacity to resist. They did everything they could to this people. So the Masons and this connection into the Jewish banking families, they basically genocided a whole race of people. And, you know, and the fact is, Tim, it's damn well deliberate. There's no, you know, when you go through Chris's website and at the end of it, you just are absolutely certain. His documentation is just airtight. They deliberately wiped these people out.
It's continued to this day because the recent the crash in 2008, you know, Ireland is called the Emerald Tiger, Irish Tiger. It's a pump and dump scheme, and Ireland was made rich, of course, through that process. Ireland lost much of its character. People were complaining about that, and then the economy crashes, and the banks are stuck holding all this bad debt, and along comes in the Irish government, and it assumes all the liabilities of the banks in the name of the Irish taxpayers. So we're back to this scheme where poor Irish are being made to pay off the debt to rich bankers. And the same thing occurred in the 19th century. Like this scheme where they got to buy back the land that was stolen from them generations before. And for the better part of a century, they made these payments, these biannual payments.
Which went all the way up into the 20th century.
Yeah, in 1970 or something.
They were paying off, you know, these so-called debts.
Chris Fogarty's own family paid that. He said
to buy back the land that was stolen from him.
Basically, what it was whatever profit you had in your land, you paid in tax. That's what it came down to. That's how you keep everyone poor. And Chris Fogarty he's an interesting story because he was in America, and his father, in 1939, wanted to emigrate back to Ireland, but then the war interceded. After the war, they went to Ireland because they thought America was turning communist under FDR. You know, maybe slightly overstated, but not completely off base. And so they went to Ireland, went back to live to Ireland again. And his father worked in the United States, paid off the mortgage for the farm, and they lived there. So he's an American who actually went back to Ireland, which is usually it's the reverse. And then he had a very interesting life where he was an engineer, civil engineer. He traveled the world, like in East Asia and Borneo and all that stuff. Borneo. So, you know, he's a well-traveled, very interesting guy. Then he finally settled back in Chicago where his family was, where he was born. His father was paying off that tax. Of course, his great-grandfather was a British soldier in one of these regiments that worked to dispossess the Irish. That's where he started doing the research. He was looking into his family, you know, his pedigree, and he uncovered this.
Wow. And so one of the things that was shocking to me when I went through Chris's documentation were the actual statements by British Masons of awareness of the genocide.
Yeah, it shows their intent, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Carlyle wrote, supposedly a enlightened essayist.
Yes.
Like a guy who, man of letters. And he wrote, you know, Ireland is like a half-starved rat that crosses the path of an elephant. What must the elephant do? Squelch it. By heaven, squelch it. Total annihilation.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and there was Queen Victoria's economist, Nassau Senior, who said he was upset that perhaps only a million Irish were dying in this.
Right.
In this, You had also you had
1848. Yeah,
and you had magazines like Punch, the British humor magazine, Irish Words Portrays sort of like monkeys, which is and after a while, a lot of times the British started to blame the Irish themselves, for their laziness or stupidity, the fact that they worried that if they got food relief, they'd use it to buy arms to fund a rebellion, as if a population that's starving to death has the wherewithal to start a rebellion, And one of the disappointments is the failure of the Catholic hierarchy in Ireland to defend the faithful in this, because the Irish...
Absolutely. And this shows the myth of Catholic political power, mm-hmm. because the Catholic hierarchy had been completely compromised by the Masons.
Mm-hmm.
They'd either bought them off or had inserted their own people into the positions of authority.
Mm-hmm. And they always came against any rebellion. They actually gave them... They received food relief, so Chris seemed to think that a lot of this was because the Catholics don't admit that they had done nothing about these mass grave situation, where they never bothered to consecrate these grave sites. So it's kind of covering up, because this would delegitimize them in the eyes of the faithful in Ireland. And the irony is that to this day, the Catholic Church says nothing about the Catholic martyrs in Ireland, because if they had renounced their Catholic faith and said they were Protestants, they would have gotten food. And they refused to do that. And I hear nothing of Irish martyrdom in the Catholic Church. I look at my calendar, my church calendar, and I look at January 27th. I look at January 27th, Holocaust Memorial Day. Okay? I see nothing of an Irish Holocaust Memorial Day.
Well, I guess the Irish are still, looking for some political clout, because they can't even get their Holocaust to be recognized by the Catholic Church. And that, your statement, Tim, I mean, there is basically a complete confirmation of my assertion that the Catholics never had any political power.
I mean, every time the Catholics is lectured, like a Pope is lectured about what the Pope didn't do during World War II, what they should have done in World War II, the Pope should raise, well, what about the Jewish bankers who were behind the Irish Holocaust?
Let's get to the bottom of that. And beyond that, I mean, who's running the Masons?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at European history is in the last 300 years is basically the history of Masonic genocide. That's really what we're experiencing. And there's many, many different aspects to it. This is one that is really out in the open now, thanks to Chris's research. But believe me, if you go into World War I or the Civil War, you're going to find the same thing. So we have to get to the bottom of who these people are and what is exactly in back of the Masonic urge to genocide Europeans. You see, this is just critical that we understand it, because when you have statements that are going on like from the Masonic cesspool, Mary Robinson, right, the former prime minister of Ireland, the Catholic, and she is referring to the famine as a natural disaster. This is how she characterized it.
Mm-hmm.
The cover-up is ongoing. The operation is ongoing. The Holocaust is ongoing, because you can't do anything to change the political structure, because you're not aware of the fact that the political structure you have on top of you right now is the same one that executed the Irish Holocaust in 1850.
Yeah, a good illustration of the priorities that the British had during this crisis is what's come to be known as the Don Pacifico affair.
And yeah.
Don Pacifico was a British subject who had renounced his citizenship, become a Greek citizen, and apparently had a dispute with the Greek government over some debt and some property damage that occurred during a riot. What happened was, I think it was the Greeks were either performing some sort of passion play or something, and the Rothschilds had put pressure on the local government not to have it, and the king agreed to it, but the public rioted or protested that decision. They didn't like being told what to do, and in the process, this guy's property was destroyed. And he was trying to get the government to compensate it for the property, and the government refused. And the British, this is 1846, 1847, the peak of the Irish Holocaust, the Great Hunger. Well, Palmerston sent gunships to collect the debt. But he wouldn't send relief ships to feed the Irish.
Right.
He couldn't afford to do that. And, of course, at the end of the day, it's revealed about Palmerston. Well, here it is. Oh, wrong book. I'm sorry.
Got too many of them, Tim.
Yeah, they're just as thick. It confused me. Why was Palmerston, this is out of E. Michael Jones' book, Barren Metal. Why was Palmerston so solicitous about a Portuguese Jew, that's Don Pacifico, who had renounced his citizenship but nonetheless wanted assistance in collecting his debts from the Greeks? Perhaps it was because Pacifico was acting as a proxy for the Rothschilds, who were bankrolling the government's projects across the world, including the Suez Canal. The Rothschilds needed some spectacular proof that the British government was willing to enforce the usurious contracts that allowed them to expand their empire at the helpless debtor's expense. But moving closer to home, perhaps it was because Palmerston himself was hopelessly in debt and needed the favors of the Jewish moneylenders like the Rothschilds to roll over his loans. From Palmerston to Churchill, right?
Right, and the same thing, it just keeps appearing over and over again. But, you know, you have to wonder, they have this excuse about debt, you know, that these people had debt and the Jewish bankers were just helping them. And, you know, one side has the debt and the other side has the money. And no one's really doing anything really, you know, genocidal. But, you know, these people want this and this people want. And it just becomes this kind of like the Vietnam War series by Ken Burns, where everything just fades into gray. Mm-hmm. I just don't buy it. I don't believe for a second I think it's just a cover narrative. I don't think it isn't debt that binds the Masons and the Jewish bankers. I do not believe that. I just think that's impossible. And I think
I think it's one instrument of control.
Well, it's an instrument of control, but it just can't explain the pattern. It just cannot explain such a vast and long-standing pattern. There has to be something else that binds them together. And I've made the suggestion that the high-level Masons could be crypto-Jews. Mm-hmm. And that's really the glue that holds the thing together, right? How would you prove this? Well, you know, let's have some DNA evidence. We certainly know who some of the high-level Masons are. We need to know what is their relationship into these banking families,
mm-hmm.
right? That's how we'll find out the truth. Because the pattern just repeats itself too often, Tim, in my opinion. I think the idea, there's always this debt business, but I mean, you know, Palmerston was very wealthy. Palmerston owned an entire county in Ireland.
Yeah.
He gave away 2,000 slaves to the New World just as, like, basically to move them off the property. This guy is not hurting for money.
Well, I think it goes back to, like, alchemy, you know, which goes back to debasement and these things, the debasement of matter. And it's sort of, the philosopher's stone and the power behind that. And it's often manifests itself in finance.
I really want this idea of debt to be put under more scrutiny. I mean, E. Michael Jones is someone that I think uses it without thinking clearly, because, you know, he used it like with William F. Buckley,
mm-hmm.
saying, well, Buckley was willing to crush this one guy, you know, his career as a writer or to influence him because Buckley was getting money for his magazine. But if you look into Buckley's background, his father is one of the wealthiest men in the United States. Buckley doesn't need any money to set up his magazine. The idea of, like, debt and Jewish money being the cause of the skull and bones member, William F. Buckley, to, concede basically the political position concerning Israel, man, I just don't, that makes no sense to me at all.
I think you're dealing with a level, but it doesn't get you to the core of the problem.
What's unbackable is how does the skull and bones operate?
But I'm saying the idea of financial alchemy gives a certain reveal about the philosophy behind an essential philosophy of Freemasonry, which goes back to the
Kabbalah. Well, that's
right. Kabbalah.
I'm 100%. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get, but you see, because now you're into the central banks, the Federal Reserve systems, and the whole way that money can be used as mind control.
We focus on money because we're profane.
That's
how we see it. That's how it affects us directly. That's kind
of God
where
trust.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how most people see it.
I mean, you have that statement on the dollar bill, "In God We Trust."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the statement of the Masonic rite of the Royal Arch, I believe.
It's like something like the JFK assassination or 9/11, these things where you can see all types of you can follow the money. And that's a great investigative tool or approach, because that way, that's how you unearth crimes, and that's how you make connections. That's how people are motivated. That's how operations are funded. And so it's a practical way to carry these things out. But at the same time, if you look at JFK, which you talked about last week in 9/11, it's just full of all types of Masonic imagery and rituals, right? I mean. So there's a meaning to this, and the stuff. The reason why they do this is because this. Perhaps it has some sort of, magical effect by going through this ritual. Magic to the extent that this is how they signal to each other, and this is how they hoodwink us.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think the magic at the level of the people in the high level masonry and the banking families. There's zip magic. There's no magic at all. They talk the language of power.
Yeah.
But magic, as you go down into their control, is something that they use to confuse people. And there's more and more, Aleister Crowley type magic crap that's being given to the public as just ways to wreck their minds so they can't think clearly about what's going on above them politically.
Yeah. Well, magic is like a occulted finance, right? Money out of nothing, wealth out of nothing, or occulted science where we're only given, a limited hangout of understanding of certain physical properties. And this goes back to the creation of the Royal Society, which is a Freemasonic creation. The idea that they would get control of information, occult it, and with that leverage, be able to be like gods. And that's Freemasonry. That's this.
Yeah, that's Freemasonry, and that's what we're being subjected to. And that's what obviously has happened to the Irish people today. Because I cannot understand now that Chris has brought out this information, why there isn't rebellion. I mean, what's holding them back? You look at this information.
Because the Irish now have rights. They have a right to abortion. They have gay marriage, and they're free.
The country's a gay disco.
Yeah,
it's trying to. Now, what's to rebel from? The thing is, they should realize that the culture they're living in is part of the genocide, and that the political class is a collection of lifetime actors that looks like their entire focus is just to destroy every damn Irish person out there. And so, in my opinion, if I was in Ireland under these conditions, it's a relatively small country. I would try to, use Chris's information as a platform for political action and get rid of these Masons and the banking families and try and use DNA if you have to. It'd be easy enough to do in Ireland. And find out who you're actually voting for and try to create some effective democracy to protect yourself, because you are... The Irish are not just being genocided today, and they are. They've been genocided for 300 years.
Mm-hmm.
Every single day they're facing a political class. Some group has slithered into political power. This group of Masons and the banking families have slithered into political power, and they are using that every day to wipe out this people. And it's going on right now. When you see the Masonic cesspool Mary Robinson make a statement about, this natural disaster is such a terrible thing, you don't think that she knows the truth? You don't think Mary Robinson would have this Masonic cesspool background And of course, the prime minister would have access to all of the data. My God, the stuff that Chris brings out is just completely transparent. You don't think she knows the truth, Tim?
Well, I mean, calling...
She knows the truth. Knows the truth. She's lying to the people as mind control to keep them from rebellion. The people should stand up and say, you know, use Masonic cesspool. We are sick of your lies. We've had it.
Well, it's the same thing with being taught that, you know, that the First World War was an accident of history.
Exactly. You know,
World War II was just this unforeseen outcome of the First World War.
Oh, my gosh. It was so confusing.
Or the Cold War was just, well, it's just, you know, the creation of the, you know, the Cold War and the creation of the National Security State, the CIA, these things are just sort of realpolitik decisions made by, you know, hard-nosed politicians to deal with the unforeseen circumstances of the post-war era. Well, no, it was all planned out, and you know, and it was all planned out in secret societies. That, you know, whether you whether it's the Rockefeller Foundation or the Council on Foreign Relations or the Institute for, you know, international
skull and bones,
or the Institute for Imperial, you know, the II in Britain. What's that Institute for Imperial Affairs? What's it called again?
Give me a second. I don't know. I can't remember it.
The Rhodes thing. You know, it's the analog to the CFR. That's what the CFR developed out of. Royal Institute of International Affairs.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, or Tavistock for that matter, which is linked to Rand Corporation, and, and they produced the Esalen Institute, which was started by a Jewish guy. So
yeah, it's all just this you know, secret societies that are all basically, in my opinion, related to Masonry. They're just different names for it. You know, they've basically got a number of versions of it, and it just makes it harder for the public to see through the thing because you've got the Bohemian Grove and, you know, the Round Table and, you know, the Skull and Bones. And then you've got, you know, the Royal Scottish Rite. I mean, there's just so many different groups. And it looks like everyone is, you know, like an independent actor. But believe me, it's all nonsense. It's all just one big cesspool.
And the idea of the British establishment, the Freemason, Freemasons using food as a weapon. Of course, this has occurred throughout history. I mean, you had the British Raj, the rule of India, where you had periodic famines. And the most recent one was the one in 1943, the Bengal famine, where food was taken out and then people just left to starve. This is during the Second World War. But even here in the United States, you have an example of that mentality is Henry Kissinger and his National Security Study Memorandum 200, written in December 1974. The National Security Study Memorandum 200, Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security and Overseas Interest. The study, you know, falsely claimed that population growth in so-called lesser developed third world countries, was a great threat to U.S. national security, and it called for using food as a weapon, using U.S. aid, food aid, as a contingent for introducing depopulation birth control programs. It also called for the immiseration of the third world and a 20% reduction in population. I mean, this through starvation and death and promotion of civil war. So this is something, this is something that the U.S. government declared was policy under the Ford administration, and it's been policy ever since. Because we see this sort of model. We talk about the British model in Ireland. What are they doing? This extraction and starvation. This is this central banking warfare model, or economic hitman model that John Perkins writes about, where you just go in and you create the local conditions that cause people to lose their land. They get huddled into the cities, and then you can now use them as cheap labor in factories. The British did this with the enclosure movement in the 18th century, which set up for the Industrial Revolution. This caused the problem of pauperism in England, which then they used as a pretext for transportation. They could send the surplus people to Australia, and there's a whole story there about the treatment of those people and the conditions they faced in Australia. And they're imagine being transported from Ireland to North America is bad enough, but imagine going in those days, you know, from Great Britain to Australia.
I bet half of them didn't even make the trip.
No, they didn't. And so, I mean, what's going on in Latin America? What's occurred in, throughout Asia? What's occurred in Africa? You know, with the corporations going there and extracting the mineral wealth, the oil wealth, and, you know, supporting local governments to go in and kind of do the dirty work for them. I mean, if you look at what happened in Guatemala in 1954 and Iran in 53, these things, it's an old model. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, just to go in and just dispossess the people for the benefit of some corporation, United Fruit or the Seven Sisters. And so I think one of the reasons why there's such a vigorous effort to suppress this awareness of what the British did in Ireland, because they've been doing it ever since. They don't want to expose the scam, this what's going on in the world. I mean, what's going on in Mexico with NAFTA and how it destroyed Mexican agriculture. And this set this pattern for this mass migration north, which creates all types of problems. And for every problem, there's a solution someone can profit from. This creates conditions for cheap labor near the Mexican border, which now these Fortune 500 companies are profiting from. And you can disrupt labor, you can disrupt countries, and not only extract the wealth, but exploit human flesh, exploit them directly. This goes into cheap labor, human trafficking, organ smuggling, organ harvesting, and these things.
So, you know. I wanted to mention that I would encourage everyone to follow the advice that Chris Fogarty lays out as far as what we should do now. And I particularly want to focus on his request to have people help get the Irish genocide, which is the correct term, taught in public schools, just as, you know, the Nazi Holocaust is now. And the reason why I want this to happen, the reason why I'm so hopeful that people will do this, is not that you're going to see the public schools teach this. They won't. Just absolutely, they can't, because the whole system would collapse if they teach the accurate history of this. But what you'll be able to do is you'll be able to show people very easily that, look, there was a genocide. We are teaching the children an incorrect aspect of history. And yet, look, our local representative is doing nothing to help us. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
We use this approach to expose the politicians, because what I really want is for the public to see that the political class is either basically there because of their stupidity. In other words, they've been handpicked because they're morons, or they're basically inside the deal.
Yeah, he talks about the four horsemen, Ted Kennedy, Tip O'Neill, Pat Moynihan, and Hugh Carey, who gave cover to the British establishment.
Yeah.
These Irish. And that's funny, because obviously my name's Kelly. And
yeah,
if not for this tragedy in Ireland, my grandmother never would have met my grandfather, so I wouldn't exist. And that's Irish Americans. But this lack of consciousness among Irish Americans about the plight of their predecessors. You don't get taught this. What you're taught about the Irish Great Hunger, the Irish Genocide, they call it the Irish Famine, and implicit in that description is it was the fault of the stupid primitive Irish, and the Irish didn't advance and improve themselves till they all came to Masonic America,
yeah,
and took part in the American Dream.
These are the lies that we have to believe in to accept our slavery. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just one lie after another, lie upon lie, that, you know, that the potatoes failed and look, the dumb Irish are all dying because they were just so dependent on potatoes. When the British are taking out more food than five times Irish population needed to survive.
Why don't they build huge manor homes like the British do? Right?
Maybe get the British to be slaves for a while. Yeah. You know, the ruling class.
Well, it's funny because Chris Fogarty also talks about what the conditions were like in Ireland before the British people, Irish were immiserated at the hands of the British. Is that they used to be taller than the British. They had higher, much like Americans, a much higher diet. Much better diet, more varied diet. But he also talks about what happened with the inclusion movement, had the same thing where, you had a lot of British English being shoved into the cities, into the factories, in these things, and the decline of the overall standard of living in this period of sort of forced industrialization. It's something that doesn't get much of an explanation in economic history, because we're learning that, you know, obviously there's benefits in industry and production, but what was destroyed in England with the destruction of the enclosure, and also the destruction of the monastic system during the British, the English Reformation, when all that wealth was stolen from the church by the British the upstart aristocracy, there was a way of life there. And basically, because of the vast, this is sort of the order that was established by the monasteries during the Middle Ages, how there was a social system set up that basically, if you were a person in want, you could get help. And this was destroyed when the monasteries were destroyed. And you had all in the course of the enclosure movement, they were dispossessed of the land, following the Adam Smith economic model, because they could make more money for export. See how this ideology plays out.
That's an example of like laissez-faire being just a cover narrative for genocide,
which is what the whole Newtonian process was all about. Because it wasn't morality. This was economics, and economics is a force of nature. It's just inertia and gravity. We're not doing this. It's the market doing it.
Right, I know.
And of course, behind that, of course, is a regiment of soldiers.
Exactly.
So there's no market here. I mean,
it's lie after lie.
Yeah.
Wealth of Nations is still given this kind of accolade as a, you know, coherent economic book that a lot of conservatives point to. It's mm-hmm. like, look, we don't need a welfare state. It laissez-faire. This is how the economy really works. Look, Adam Smith is a Masonic cesspool. The whole book is just a cover story so that they can kill everybody and claim they're trying to do good.
Well, he was recruited by the Whig establishment.
Yeah, I mean, he was Ben Bentham and what's his name? We're running the guy.
Thomas Malthus.
Yeah, and he just comes with this crackpot, you know, laissez-faire, which is actually, believe it or not, laissez-faire was part of what the Masonic press in Britain was wanting to ply to Ireland to try to help them with saying, look, we really shouldn't be in there giving them any food because laissez-faire, right? The market forces need mm-hmm. to operate here, and, you know, a few Irish guys will die, but that's okay because they'll be better in the long run, you know, for this.
Well, this is one way of reducing Irish poverty.
Yeah, it did, in fact, just by reducing the Irish. So, you know, I would hope that in Ireland, if people hear our talk tonight, and people who are, in Ireland, or if you know people there, for heaven's sakes, familiarize them with the work of Chris Fogarty. Follow his recommendations. He has a bunch of recommendations of stuff they need to do, and particularly try to get both here in the United States and in Ireland the schools to teach the truth about the Irish genocide. Because, see, this could become a news story just trying to get it done. Trust me, the politicians will not respond. They won't agree to this. But in the process of turning it down, we can expose them so more people become aware of the fact that the political class is still, to this day, is exactly the same group, just the current iteration, that is committing genocide. You see, this is how we can learn that we're being wiped out, is when we point out, well, here's the truth, it's absolutely documented, let's teach this in the public schools, and then the politician goes, nah, we can't do that. Well, now you know what the politician is. You know he's still engaged in the act, you see. That's why they can't ever permit the truth to come out, any part of it. If this was taught, Tim, if the Irish genocide was taught honestly in either American or Irish public schools, it would lead to rebellion. People would see immediately, wait a second, this is still going on. These are the same people. They would be able to trace these people through time, their families, and they could understand what was going on. And then the question that I had raised earlier about, well, who are these people? What is the connection between these Masonic groups and the Jewish banking families? Mm-hmm. How does it work? It's every time you see these kinds of events, you see the two groups in cooperation. How does that work? You know, what goes on there?
Yeah.
What agreement do they have? You know, so remember that when Palmerston starts this, because you can actually pretty well trace the what's called the famine to Palmerston's activity in 1845 when he was the first one to actually export a gigantic group of Irish. So he was actually anticipating what was about to occur. He's also the guy who starts Zionism. Now, this is just too much of a weird coincidence for my taste. I want to get to the bottom of this.
From what I understand, the Ulster Republic,
yeah,
they have a six-pointed star in their flag.
Yeah, isn't that odd?
You know? No, they say it symbolizes the six counties. That, you know.
Oh, I'm just happy as can be about that. I really want to get to the bottom of that. You know, I mean, you see, these kinds of symbols are just very suspicious to me. And I really want to, at this point, really, I mean, Tim, I know people are going to say, oh, gee, you know, anti-Semitism. Well, you know something? Aren't we, given the fact that here is clear evidence we're being genocided, entitled to a little bit of curiosity and skepticism? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say? Right? So that's what I'm trying to do here. I just want to get to the bottom of a genocide that is not taught in the public schools and is going on today. You know, the Nazi Holocaust is taught in the public schools and is not going on today. So let's apply some energy to the Irish genocide to see, why wasn't it ever brought to light? Why are they all lying about it? Right now, Mary Robinson, that criminal who is the prime minister of Ireland, to lie like that, right? Because you damn well know she has the truth. She's got it. She understands the truth. So she's lying. She lied in 1995, and she's lying today.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going on. The genocide, because it hasn't been exposed, it isn't taught in the correct way, it's going on today. It's still going on. We've got to expose this. And so, I'm usually not so emotional. I try to stay calm, you know, but I'm getting angry as we talk.
Because of one Holocaust, of course, it wasn't called a Holocaust until the 1970s. It used to be called the Shoah, I guess, but because of that Holocaust, we cannot expose any others because
right, and that's really odd to me. And
that Holocaust justifies all the others, apparently. You know,
so. Well, it transcends them. It becomes the only Holocaust as possible to have in your mind. But here we have a Holocaust that isn't taught and that is being covered up currently by the current political crop. The Irish political class know the data that Chris Fogarty has brought out.
Mm-hmm.
There is absolutely no chance that they do not. They
actively suppress it. He was talking. There's a teacher. They can't teach it legally.
Right.
It's the creation of the government.
In fact, the interview you did with Fogarty, I hope everyone listens to it. It's on YouTube. It's a great interview. I thought that was one of the best interviews I've ever listened to on YouTube. And Fogarty's just very clear cut. He goes, "Yeah, they are suppressing it today," and he actually gives examples of how they're doing it.
Yeah, and I mean the fact that he was targeted by the FBI for his activism about another country. What does that say?
That's an example.
I mean, that's how much pull they have.
So anyway, this is So I mean, there it is, Tim. It was an operation against the Irish. It was genocide, and because If the truth about it was brought out, the political class, which is the descendant of the group that perpetuated or that committed the genocide, the political class today would be exposed. They are suppressing it today. So I'm saying that the operation is ongoing.
Yeah, it's the same. I mean, like I said, National Security Study Memorandum 200, 1974. And that's ongoing because we see it being carried out in the various fomented civil wars and problems in Africa. In the name of resource extraction. You see it in Syria We see it in Yemen. I mean, you can read a story about Yemen, how Saudi Arabia is prosecuting this war in Yemen with American arms. And you hear this. No one votes for this. Did anyone vote for this in an election? No, it just happens. Like, the national security state does this. The deep state does it. The arms merchants. They're merchants of death.
And the American citizen is given this this lie that they have political power.
I mean, all this is going on. You know, all this death, destruction being meted out in our name.
Genocide all over the planet. Yeah. It's all being carried out by the United States, and the citizen isn't even aware. Its representatives, you know, were never even called in to like authorize any of this stuff. I mean, it is all just coming from deep state in the president. You know, the constitutional process to declare war is just out the window. So
no, our job is just salute. See, thank you for your service. Thank you for guarding the poppy fields in Afghanistan, because we need that lucrative heroin market to capitalize the banks in Wall Street to keep the whole damn thing going.
Yeah. But, you know, I'll tell you, the little, you know, every once in a while, little bits of change are occurring. I noticed that the NAACP is bringing action against the Star Spangled Banner because of they are well aware now. And I kind of wonder and hope that is the case, that you know, our discussion was circulated and maybe part of what inspired them to take the action. Because in the news release, they actually cite basically the position you and I took on it verbatim.
Mm-hmm. That's how that's going to play. That's part of a dialectic, because that's just going to get all the, you know, the country western music listeners and the good old boys and the patriotic Americans all upset, because, you know, that's...
Maybe that's how they're going to have to play it. But I'll tell you one thing. If at the same time the Masonic Irish genocide is brought to light to the American people, right? And then you look at Francis Scott Key's Masonic stanza, because that stanza is I can show it to you, but it's just absolutely Masonic. Then maybe they will put one and one together, and they go, you know something? The good old boys who, you know, are always ready to salute the flag and have the patriotism. Well, wait a second. A lot of the good old boys have Irish backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And gee whiz, these guys were committing genocide. They want on us. They won't fess up to it for some reason. And this this Star Spangled Banner thing, it talks about the polluted, footsteps not being washed clean, and they talk about the hireling and the slaves. Well, gee, Tim, who do you think the hirelings were?
Mm-hmm.
They were the Irish, you see.
Well, that's why it was so important to deracinate.
Exactly.
Ethnic America, because
they had memories
of these things. It's good. It's good to hold a grudge, right? It's healthy.
Yeah, we shouldn't hold a grudge. Just take the genocide on the chin like a good patriot, you know.
You love your enemies, but don't deny that you have them. Come on.
Yeah. So anyway, this is I think, you know, so clear cut that it's what I call like a fingerprint of the oligarchs. It's sort of like the MK Ultra pay requisition of Gordon Wasson or Gloria Steinem's, you know, CIA activities. You know, you get from time to time you get to see them destroying people and wrecking culture, and you can see the Masonic
I just think you put too much stress on the Masonic stuff. I think you're just a conspiracy theorist, because, you know, Washington may be one big Masonic temple, and every town in the United States and throughout the Anglophone world has a Masonic temple in it, but it's nothing. It doesn't mean anything. They're just out there, you know, they're just getting drunk and playing ping pong.
I look at the dollar bill and I see the all-seeing eye, and I just wonder if it means anything, you know?
No, they just put it there. It doesn't mean anything.
You're right. In God we trust, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, I think this has been, useful, and I hope that Tim, I'm hoping that we were a small part of the influence that has led the NAACP to realize that they shouldn't be using the Star Spangled Banner as an advertisement for recruitment in the inner cities, because mm-hmm. it's It's vulgar and distasteful. You know, when you look at the whole process, I would hope that maybe in a couple months we'll see Irish groups in America. And there are some going, you know, we really want to revisit how the public schools teach what happened in Ireland during the genocide period. You know, it would just
Joe, that may be true. That Prince George is so cute.
Yeah, he is so cute. He's so darling.
You know, and it was so romantic. And then what's her name? Pippi or what's her name? Pippa.
Pippa. She has the historically significant derriere, you know, because
Yes, that's important.
Yeah, these are the important things we need to be focused upon. Yeah, the
British. I mean, it's like the British propaganda apparatus is so it's so normalized we don't even recognize it.
We don't even see it. Yeah, exactly. It's all around. But anyway, I mean, you know,
I'm sorry, not British, Masonic.
Masonic, exactly. We gotta like a not famine, but Holocaust.
Holocaust,
not British, but Masonic. You know, we've got to start getting the terms right. But I do hope that we are, you know, a part of a process that in a few months we'll start to see bubble up into the media, where small newspapers will be reporting that Irish groups are. Asking for more data about what happened during this period. Mm-hmm. Why are we talking about a famine when in fact it was a deliberate genocide? You know, why isn't that being taught? I'd like to see that happen.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I think we know the answer why it's not being taught, but it's a question.
Then the Irish groups will go, well, we have our answer.
Yes.
We now know the truth. We're going to take our responsibility to teach our children exactly what happened. And part of what we're going to teach them is that these lying cesspool politicians, right, are still engaged in the act. So the kids will know what we're dealing with.
It's very sophisticated. I mean, Tony Blair admitted that the British government was guilty of indifference.
Yeah. Well, it's like Mary Robinson calling it a great natural disaster. See, they you know how they mind control. They it's Ken Burns with the Vietnam saga, you know,
just the absent-mindedness, good intentions.
LBJ, he really wanted to do something good, but just somehow couldn't do anything other than kill everybody.
But he
had it in mind to do something, you know, important and significant, and like you know, do something about communism. But he was just tortured. And you know, in the meantime, they are, like, as I mentioned, this one friend of mine who was in Vietnam said that, you know, they would send out platoons of different sizes, and they would keep reducing the number until they would get down to the number that would be small enough for the Viet Cong to attack, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that they would say, well, we're trying to engage the enemy. You know, we need the enemy to engage. And these were basically just slaughters, you know, because they wouldn't attack until they could just wipe them all out, you know.
Yeah, because if the goal in Vietnam was to go and just take over the place, it could have been done, you know, in a month.
Or, you know, yeah. But the goal in Vietnam was to traumatize and to reduce population. And then the kids that came back that, you know, weren't on heroin were traumatized to the extent where they were wide open for the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture.
Yeah, they run up the bill, increase the death toll, get the media spinning with its reports and these things. It's all very Masonic because everyone's playing their role because the soldier in country going on these search and destroy missions was as much a tool of that. Same with the anti-war protester back in the States burning the draft card or going to rock
festival. Exactly right. And they didn't understand it because it was they set up this dialectic. But the fact is they were both just being manipulated for destruction. It was cultural destruction as well as physical destruction, but it was both sides. On both sides of the Pacific, they were just wiping us out. But so again, it's just
alchemy. Alchemy. It gets us back to Freemasonry. Yeah. It's all alchemy.
Well, we've got it. We've got to like stop them using these systems against us. Basically, anytime we're getting wiped out, we should suspect that that we're being manipulated and that the political class is responsible. First thing to understand, the genocidists, this group, has slithered into all of the positions of political power. And you can't just depend on democracy to put forward a candidate somehow that's going to be outside of their control. You see, this is the first thing to understand. We've got to have more understanding of who the political class is, what they are, what is the connections, you know, between them. And then we've got to find a way to get some people in some political power that are different, that are coming from a different group, that have the courage to stand up to this. Because, like I say, if we could get 5% of the people aware and angry, in 2 months we'd have 50% of the population. Mm-hmm. Because the intimidation would just fall away. It's all kept in place, if you think about it. I mean, think about like the Irish, you know, situation in terms of like 911. Why is 911 still believed as, I mean, you know, in all of the mass media's position regarding it, is still even, you know, coherent to the population? It's because they're intimidated. No, I mean, there's, look, a large fraction of the population knows that 911 could not have been as the official narrative is.
Look at the JFK assassination, where it's like two-thirds.
But there's intimidation. They don't want to go at a cocktail party. Well, you know, I don't actually buy that story. I think it was an inside job. They're afraid to say it. You get 5% of the population with the anger and courage to tell the truth, then you'll see that there will be another large fraction that will come in line immediately. And they'll go, you know, I've always wanted to talk about this. I've always had my doubts. I do agree with you. Let's talk about when you're going to see a steamrolling effect. And the same thing is possible here with the Irish genocide, because the documentation is that good and the crime is that horrific. And it's going on right now because the cover up is going on as we are sitting here talking.
Yeah, I was a lot of these events, the Irish, you know, the Great Hunger in Ireland, the Irish genocide, World War One, World War Two, they just seem so insane that it's hard to believe that there's any coherence to it. But there is. There's high level malevolence being planned out. And right. I have a copy of Catch 22 here.
Yeah.
It's a novel that I've never bothered to read. I have a copy. I've never had the time, but I want to read it. But it's kind of funny. It's on the back dust cover. It goes, set in the closing months of World War II, an American bomber squadron off Italy. Catch 22 is a story of a bombardier named Yossarian, who is frantic and furious because thousands of people he hasn't even met are keep trying to kill him. And right. that's almost like the plight of the everyday guy. I mean, it just is the whole thing. Just he's just thrown into this, you know, this maelstrom of destruction, war, genocide, and he's just told to do his job.
The author, certainly was on the inside. He was like
Joseph Heller, yeah.
Yeah, Heller was on the inside, as was, Salinger. Because the veils of Holden Caulfield, you can, you know, go to Post-Leviana, you've got my take on that, and I think it's clear cut. You can see it's just, the whole thing is a Masonic homage. When Heller starts talking about, you know, like one guy is there. I mean, what Heller is doing with that character is he is representing the actual plight of the people participating in the war, that they don't understand that that all of the people that are trying to kill them are being manipulated into position. You see, this is what he's representing. It's that we're all just being moved around this chessboard by people who have political power, and the purpose of the game, kill us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I say, it's like, you hear, let's say you're on a farm in December 1941 and hear on the radio, the afternoon radio, that Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor. And you're in Iowa.
Right.
You're supposed to care about a military outpost on an island that was stolen 70 years, you know, 50 years before for the benefit of sugar interests, corporations, but the thing is, people have to be aware of that. Instead of being taken in by the flag and patriotism and all the propaganda, just a little awareness of the history and the facts as an individual,
just an awareness of how Roosevelt maneuvered the Japanese, so they had no other choice but to invade. It was which they perfectly knew was going to occur, and in fact had been planning the thing to happen, so then they would have the justification for the war.
And this is how a farm boy ends up drowning in the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah. Well, Pearl Harbor was just a 9-1-1. That's all it is. It was just they maneuvered the Japanese into position, just like supposedly the Arabs may have been maneuvered into position. But I will tell you, I think it's very interesting. The code word for the attack was Tora, Tora, Tora.
Mm-hmm.
and if you ever look into the history of Freemasonry in Japan, it's an ugly picture, brother.
That's true. That was introduced by, was that Commodore Perry?
Perry brought it there, and then...
Who had married into the Rothschild family via...
Oddly enough, yeah, that's something. See, now, Tim, it's incredible. Look, here's another example of what I was talking about. You see, you have the Masons and then you have the Rothschild family. What the heck's going on in Japan, for God's sake, setting up Freemasonry? This is odd. Tora, Tora, Tora?
And it was August Belmont who was behind Manifest Destiny, that meme, and also... some say was fomenting the so-called American Civil War.
Of course,
a few years later.
Manifest Destiny, the Civil, which is taking out the Indians, and then they've got the Civil War coming. To reduce the population, they're sending the Irish, the poor Irish. God,
and the Irish. By the way, where did the Irish end up on the battlefields?
On the battlefield, on both sides of the. Of once, I mean, it's
at least they're being fed and given a coat.
Yeah, you're right, and a gun. You know what? I'm just sick of it, and the genocide has gone on long enough. And the facade of the history that they give us so that we don't, rebel, I think it's just being broken apart, shattering.
And the other Irish that had survived Jamaica and escaped to the American South end up fighting their cousins. who were imported.
Well, sure. I mean, exactly. I mean, they get them on both sides, and here you go, just walk into each other. I mean, it's World War I. There's just different names on the uniforms, but the fact is they set up the weapons.
It's just no one could foresee that machine gun fire would do that to each other. And it would gun down Muslims and Africans, but it wouldn't do that to white people. So you couldn't foresee if you charge... machine gun emplacements that you get mowed down in the tens of thousands. You can't foresee that.
I was listening. I saw this on Facebook. Which there's all these videos that roll on. And they disappear. I don't know where it is, but it was Noam Chomsky, the Lifetime actor, genocidist, and he was talking about. He was going, well, Israel really always had this great support from the British elite. And then he was going on and on about how, all of these, and he said this because they were Christian. They were really devout Christians and they really believed in the Bible. And the Bible says the Jews are going to go back. So it's really kind of understandable how they actually, these British elite, kind of like helped Zionism and then, helped with the Balfour Declaration and set up Israel. And I was thinking, Noam, maybe you should bring up the idea that they're all Freemasons. Wouldn't that be a little bit better than calling them devout Christians? Because you can't be a devout Christian and a Freemason.
No.
And that's just impossible. Look at the oaths they have to take. You just can't do it. It's one or the other. So when you've got the whole lump of people promoting Zionism as Masons, 100% of all these Brit, from the Quattro Coronati to the all of the political class and then the royal family, they're all Masons. They're the ones that are promoting Zionism. But an old Noam Chomsky, gosh darn it, he's such a lovable old guy. He just has a nice little way of talking. He's just sweet as can be. He doesn't know it. He just can't quite get his arms around it. Just like Mary Robinson, the Masonic cesspool, even though her family is Masonic, her husband is the second leading Mason in Ireland, and the Masons gave her this giant honor after she left office. Tim, it's just incredible. She didn't know that they were all Masons. She doesn't even bring it up. You know, she must not know. I guess that just slipped her mind. Somehow it didn't get into the information loop, right? So she talks about the natural disaster, except it's 100% controlled by the Masons, and she doesn't mention it.
Mm-hmm. You know? Noam Chomsky mentioned that the Bible he's citing is, was that the Schofield Bible?
Yeah, the Schofield Bible, right. This is just preposterous.
And who commissioned that, right?
It's just lie after lie after lie. And it's about time that we started to wake the hell up and say, you know, I'm just sick of the lies. Because with Chomsky, you get the lies are really very, they're very precisely designed.
Well, he does criticize CIA and Big Oil.
Oh, I know.
So he must be on our side.
He gets so much credibility. It's like, Aldous Huxley saying, gee, I really hope the government doesn't get any control over our minds with these, you know, drugs and stuff. And then you get the MKUltra pay requisitions and you see that he's administrating, right? He's actually ordering different, you know, he's actually conducting the development of the technology that he's warning us about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so anyway. Yeah, so Chomsky is a good guy to study just from the fact that he is an absolute 100% liar, and basically, he's a lifetime actor. He's just there to develop credibility with his smooth kind of like I don't know how to describe his way of talking. It's just, I mean, I suppose it's being, you know, he's as an actor, he's developed a way to seem like he's calm and reasonable, you know, because it's kind of the slow motion method of talking.
Yeah.
But
he was there to spar with William F. Buckley and all that, you know, that you can watch the fight. Yeah. It's like watching the wrestling, professional wrestling on Saturday or something. It's, you know, it's put out for
but
us.
But it's just, you know. It's a complete lie. And so anyway, we'll go after him again next week, okay?
Sounds good. Joe, you have a nice weekend.
Yeah, you too, Tim. Thanks so much. And from now on, we're calling you O'Kelly.
O'Kelly, that's right. That's originally what it was from. Yeah, if I understand, it's Central Ireland. Central Ireland is where the Kellys come from. So.
And you're O'Kelly. Descendant of the Kellys, right. So you have the tradition. So
okay. All right. I'll let you go.
Soon,
bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.